Don't underestimate the power of intentionality and care and commitment to getting something done. On really big issues, they rarely are stagnant. Big dynamics want to move, and they'll move in positive or negative ways based on how we behave, right? Because they want to go in that direction. So we either create virtuous cycles or vicious cycles. But nature has us moving towards one or the other. So our job is create as many virtuous cycles as possible, and then virtuous cycles hit other virtuous cycles, and things start to happen. Things become possible that heretofore were not.
Hello, and welcome to the Conspiracy of Goodness podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Linda Ulrich. We have been interviewing for about 3.5 years now folks who are doing the most amazing things in the world. They're thinking fresh thoughts. They're asking better questions. They're showing us a different side to leadership than we normally think of. The folks that we're interviewing here on the Goodness Exchange go all the way from astronauts to a wonderful young 18-year-old I met on a park bench one day. So today we're going to interview someone who has the most extraordinary background in helping others feel invited into a mindset of possibility. Kyle Dodson is a consultant who supports youth, family, and community-focused organizations. He is formerly the president and CEO of the Greater Burlington YMCA, a position he held since 2016 until recently. And his big claim to fame there was that Kyle and a fabulous team of others combined their strengths to raise $20 million to make the Greater Burlington YMCA that we have today a reality. It was an extraordinary effort, and you will see through this interview why Kyle was so adept and energetic at making that sort of thing happen. Beyond his professional connections to the community, Kyle has been engaged in several organizations, including being the co-chair of the Racial Equity Committee for the Vermont Business Roundtable Education Task Force. And because of his wonderful energy and openness, for 2 years through 4 sessions, he has been the MC at a marvelous innovation conference that I attend every year called Sea Change in Burlington, Vermont. Kyle holds a doctoral degree in education leadership and policy studies from the University of Vermont. He has an MBA in finance and management from Columbia, and his bachelor's of arts degree from Harvard serves him every single day, I'm sure. And today we're going to interview Kyle about his insights when it comes to inviting others into this mindset of possibility that I see throughout all of his work. Because to me, that's what the scope of Kyle's body of work boils down to. When people with Kyle's brand of good energy and wisdom create a circle, in that circle, an ethos, an amazing energy tends to make anything happen. So welcome, Kyle Dodson.
Thank you, Linda. It's a pleasure to be here. I consider it an honor and a privilege to have this conversation with you. I love that idea, just quickly, a conspiracy of goodness. I'm sure that you would agree, this isn't some Pollyanna-ish venture, right? That you can, it comes down to a choice, right? Every day, unfortunately, there are difficult things that happen in the world, but there are also beautiful, sublime, wonderful things happening every day. And there's a choice about where we put our attention, quite frankly. And then you create a self-fulfilling prophecy. Whichever way you put your attention, that's really the path that gets set. And so I really see this as about intentionality, about understanding and heralding the goodness that exists.
Well, I tell you, that's exactly what I have seen in all of our interactions together, is that Kyle and I have had some pre-calls where we just cover just about everything there is to cover in the universe. And we both have this real excitement about missed potential that can be easily ignited and the wonder in others. I've seen that a lot in our conversation together. Kyle, you just have a way of seeing, looking for probably first, and then seeing the wonder and possibility in others, which is a great energy to be in.
Yeah, thanks. I think that I feel very lucky to have that predisposition, to have that level of curiosity. And it continues to be the case that when you show up with people that way, it's amazing what comes out. It's within each of us. And given the opportunity and given the invitation, most people just show you a self that is warm, and brilliant and the kind of persona that if we could bring that out of more people, I really believe we would be better able to face many of the challenges, many of them daunting, that are presented to us daily as we move through the world.
So one of the things I wanted to start with was the thing that you said to me in one of our pre-calls that I think is really, I feel like society is right on the bubble to embracing. You said there is a need for community crossroads. We need to weave the threads of our community together. And that really, to me, embodies the way you live and operate too. Talk to us about what you mean by community crossroads.
Yes, thank you for that prompt, Linda. I would say that that thought on my part is prompted by the reality that life, I would imagine always and increasingly so in such a tech-driven world where we literally can create silos just by putting on our headphones. We create echo chambers, right? It's always been the case socially because of geography, class, race, that we as humans generally live in fairly homogeneous sub-communities, right? We might, even if we live in a diverse community, the little world around ourselves, even if it's within a nuclear family, is often more homogeneous than the larger. And we can, often that homogeneous space is safe because we understand it, we know it, we have a certain position within that. And there's this kind of cycle, vicious, I would argue it's a vicious cycle of us just kind of spiraling further within that silo. And what that does, although it can be comforting, which is important, it's important to give us a sense of safety and security, but there's no growth, there's stagnancy, and there's reinforcing of a perspective. And most importantly, it can lead to righteousness. And righteousness, that's the that's the third rail. Because once you're righteous, it's the beginning of the end. And if we zoom out, it's impossible for 8 billion people on the globe to all be right. It's just like, let's move into math. One can see the absolute untenability of a perspective that has one thinking they are right, period, hard stop. So these crossroads, for me, are an opportunity for us to have exposure to all the other viewpoints out there, all the other ways of moving through the world. And if we do it with humility and curiosity and love in our heart, and openness in our mind, I think we quickly, in relationship, move from scary to exciting, right? So the other can be scary from a distance. And the closer the other gets, I think it becomes less and less scary. And then through a process, and it's not immediate. That's why we need opportunities like Sea Change and other opportunities that have some amount of duration to them, right? So the leaders of Sea Change, over time, they've changed. So I've been, you mentioned, Linda, 2 years, 4 different sessions. And one of the things that's been the case is they've really intensified their communication to participants that it's important that you involve yourself in all of it. They don't want you dipping in and dipping out. I'm going to go to a session, then I'm going to go do my work. I'm going to go take care of this report. Try it. They know it's difficult, but come and engage in the whole thing. And over that duration, there's an evolution in relationship. And that evolution, I think, moves towards a better place.
Absolutely. And you know, that I just want to put in one more pitch for Sea Change, or the ethos of Sea Change, which could be adopted universally in all kinds of conferences of the future. But their speakers stay and are just part of the group and part of learning and churning with every meal together and in the hallways. And, you know, folks in the audience who aren't familiar with Sea Change will know that I interviewed 5 of the speakers from the fall of 2023 who have been guests on this podcast. Amazing people. So we'll put those in the show notes because those conversations on this podcast have been remarkable. We got to celebrate ideas again instead of ideas that divide us. Talk to us about division a little bit in a more positive way like you would.
I agree, Linda. And I think that you are just currently by sharing the fact that there's a follow-up, right? So part of the challenge that all of us who participate in Sea Change, the challenge to us is to disseminate that ethos, is to take what we learn, what we feel, what we experience, and make it bigger than 2 days at this beautiful work incubator investment space in Burlington. That's lovely, but that's not enough. That's not adequate to the challenge. And so you're doing that. So you are spreading ripple by reaching out to people you've met there, talking to them. And then I presume the podcast goes out into the ether, right? Yes. And it's out there for who knows who it can touch and make it bigger. You know, I'll share a quick story that in the same way. So I'm at Sea Change. After one of the sessions, a young man comes up to me, 21, 22 year young kid. And it was lovely. It was very flattering. He seemed to be moved by the work I'd done in emceeing. And he introduced himself. He's a Champlain College student. And it turns out he had this idea for community service. Now, he's a finance guy. He's working towards his certified financial analyst, CFA. For those in the audience who know, that's a very rigorous process to get the CFA. And so he's a numbers guy, but he's talking to me because he has this idea for a community kitchen. He wants to serve meals to the community as a way to bring people together, breaking bread, communing, and as a way to deal with potential food insecurity issues, people who would need that meal. And so we talk, and through connections, we're like, hey, you might know I used to work at the Y. The Y has a space that I think could be used for this kind of thing. Before I left, we were talking about how do we do more convening. I'm going to connect you to one of my former colleagues. Just last week, I had a lunch here at my house. Him, another young man from college, my colleague from the Y, and I sat down. I made us some nice pastrami Reuben sandwiches. We talked. They're going to the Y today, this afternoon, to tour the space, and this thing might happen. And Sea Change set all that in motion.
Mm-hmm. This is, I'm going to start, sometimes with people's interviews, and I can tell yours is going to be one of them, I start making little hash marks on my notes for how many times I get goosebumps. Thank you. We have to thank people who give us goosebumps for their ideas. This sense of community, you know, I think it comes from your story, Kyle, because you have an unusual story. You wound up living in a place that's not very diverse, Vermont, for all our, the wealth of things that we have, you know, a diversity is not one of them, but you have the most extraordinary way of turning things that might not be positive into all kinds of potential. So talk to us about your story and how this sense of community comes from how you grew up and how you wound up here and what you've learned from it all.
Great. Thanks, Linda. And I might have a nice little story that kind of encapsulates it so that we can make this thing less than an epic saga and link. recently, I've been connecting with my best friend from Western Orange, New Jersey. I grew up in Western Orange, New Jersey. In Jersey and in high population places, sometimes suburb doesn't capture it because they are places that for me are often more dynamic than a traditional suburb, but they're clearly not inner city, right? So in my case, Newark is the city. Newark, New Jersey is the city. And then there's all these communities around them, but those communities have their own thing. It's not like people have to go to Newark to find it. There's restaurants and businesses and everything. They're pretty robust towns. And so I grew up in a town like that, this place, West Orange, south side of Newark. In a place like that, you get interesting racial kind of distribution. So, you know, like many Northeast cities, they were immigrant cities, Newark, right? And so Italians and Jews and Poles and Irish. And then people moved out, right, in that migration from the cities to suburbs. West Orange is one of those places. So West Orange, the people who moved there were a lot of blue-collar professions, as was often the case, right? So we had cops and firemen and plumbers and electricians and lots of landscapers. And it was a middle-class place, though, because it was so dynamic economically, folks who were laborers made money. So it was a middle-class community. Well, actually, it went from it ran the gamut socioeconomically. Incredibly socioeconomically diverse, reasonably racially diverse. My subgroup of friends was particularly diverse. So in my group, we're like 10 to 12, a couple of Jewish dudes, Italian guy, an Irish guy, an Indian dude, three black dudes, one of them from Guyana. So, you know, kind of a different angle. We're all very close. So my world was diverse. And through sports, my world was diverse. My high school, not as diverse. So the story is talk to my best friend, Joe Norton, Irish dude, and we played basketball together in high school. And the interesting thing is Joe is a Division I baseball player. He went to Rutgers on a baseball scholarship for pitching, but he was a basketball player that I don't think he would mind me saying was probably sixth, seventh man. And for those of you, there's five basketball players. So the sixth, seventh man is a substitute. So he wasn't a star in basketball, but we had this coach, and this coach really helped, I think, for all of us define what community was, define what character was, honesty, integrity, commitment. He came into a town. When he came, our basketball team was 2-20. The high school basketball team was 2-20. But my cohort were in sixth grade. So he knew that his task was to kind of do triage on the current set of players in high school and to build the future. If we were going to have a successful program, we had to build the future. So simultaneously, he coached those current 10th, 11th, 12th graders and was working with sixth graders to say, hey, if you want to be a better basketball player, here are these opportunities. Here's what it's going to take. Basketball camps, leagues, et cetera. And meanwhile, he's developing a relationship with us. He's developing this caring relationship where he is a supplement to our parents. And all these guys I'm talking about were luckily we had present parents who loved us, cared for us, but it takes a village. And this guy was one of the leaders of that village of people to care of us. Long story short, 2-20 he gets. By the time I'm a junior, we're 21-5. We're state sectional champs. We've got kids going on to play basketball in college. I did. And he really created a success story. And so I'm on this email in this text thread now. So that was 1984. I graduated high school. I'm talking to this guy, his assistant coach when we were in junior high school. So this is around 1978, 79. My friend, the basketball player, this woman who went to high school with us, she was the star of the women's basketball team. And all of us are still in community. We all still care about each other. And we were talking about the state of youth mentoring today. And a little bit of a lament that for a whole bunch of reasons, we're not seeing young people necessarily have the access to this mentoring village that we had where you're developing this idea of community. And so that is a somewhat long story to say my idea that we're in this together, that with intentionality and commitment, we can build something bigger than what we start with, that it has staying power, it lasts, it creates bonds. It wasn't about basketball. Basketball was a vehicle, right? It was never about basketball. And this guy got that. We didn't. We're kids. We didn't know. We didn't understand life, but he understood that his task was to do something using a mechanism that we cared about. We cared about basketball. And his idea was to almost like a smoke and mirrors and hocus pocus, have us have an experience that was so much bigger than basketball. We didn't even know it at the time. We thought we were trying to win games and we were trying to learn how to do life, how to be full, comprehensive, big-hearted, loving, caring, believing human beings. You had to believe to think that 2-20 could be, you know, could be turned around. This guy did, and he had us believe. And we were playing towns with better athletes, better facilities, right? We didn't have all the stuff, but we had the special sauce. So that lesson has stuck with me, and I've tried to recreate that sense of community, that sense of caring, that sense of doing the work. You and I, Linda, talked about doing the work. You know, when I was a kid, there were times some of my friends were off, you know, doing things that lots of young people do, and I'd be shooting jump shots, or I'd be, you know, going for runs to get my stamina together, doing things that not every 12, 13, 14-year-old kid is doing by choice, right? Once again, that's the beauty is that I had a choice because this individual coach helped me see a vision for myself, for our team, for this group of young people that was appealing, compelling, and it's really stuck with me.
So you probably had this sense of community sort of baked in to the pie so that you could land anywhere. I'm just assuming that made you so you could land anywhere and flourish.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Quick story about Harvard. So I grew up working middle class. Neither of my parents went to college. My dad, high school dropout, military. He's a Marine. Wonderful people, hardworking, incredibly smart. Both of my parents went to a time when I think in many ways, probably American public education was in a better place. And all sorts of objective criteria would suggest that. And so they were really just great parents who gave me a great deal of support to kind of flourish and to grow and do better. But Harvard was very removed from our experience. And so I went there on a recruiting visit, and there was a young man on the JV, junior varsity, waiting for varsity practice, which I was watching. And I talked to him, and it was this Italian dude, Carmen Scarpa, and he was a regular guy. He wasn't a White House penny packer, Cabot, Adams, Lodge. He was just like a regular, I grew up with this dude. And I said, if he likes this place, maybe there's more to this place than what the media says, because this feels comfortable. This feels like my town. And literally, that was probably the most important thing in causing me. And like you said, I went to Harvard and all those fancy people. I went to kids school with kids whose names were on the building. The family name was on the building, but there were other kids just like me who got this incredible opportunity to go to this storied place, and being able to be in that place and still be the guy who was part of that team that went from 2-20 to 21-5. And that guy was able to stay. That understanding of the world and who I am in it stayed with me, even through all this privilege and access to other things. I still see myself as that person. I mean, even today, I've had unbelievable opportunities to be in so many varied and, you know, highfalutin places, for lack of a better term. But I always feel like that guy sitting in a diner in West Orange, New Jersey, talking with my community and just living. And so I feel comfortable everywhere I go.
Mm. You know, my husband and I were childhood sweethearts. We started dating when we were 14, and we have a similar, our version of what you just talked about, but in a rural farming town in Illinois. And on the family farm that I grew up on, you know, we would slaughter 4 to 7 hogs every fall and learn to eat pig's ears and skin. And yeah. The big thing was head cheese. Well, we would have to make the head cheese, which is what you make out of everything that you didn't choose for the meat. And so whenever I'm with folks who I can tell are judging or writing the story about me, I usually just, if I can, I slide into I remember I was picking out some granite for a new house that we were building 25 years ago, when granite was just the beginning of being popular. And I went to Montreal, because we live near Montreal, and we're in very broken French to these stone cutters in this weird place that we wound up. And we could tell they were not digging us. They were just not digging us. So, well, we pulled out the old head cheese comment. We could say that much in French, and we got, you know, this particular one looks just like head cheese. And they were, in French, totally taken aback that we knew what head cheese was. And we got in this giant conversation about the old days and food and making what you could out of every part of the pig. And then they were like, no, you don't want this piece. You want this piece. And they took us to the special spot. And my point for telling that story is that there's probably 10 versions of that out there. There was probably hundreds or thousands of versions of that, where we can all connect with each other on something we never, ever dreamed was in the other. If you're just curious enough, you'd find all kinds of wonder in each other in unusual places. If we can just let go of these stereotypes, if we can let go of our judgment and just go at things as if we're building a community.
That's correct.
Lovely. Okay. And one of the things that I love to hear you talk about is, I think, one of the number one parts of this finding and creating community all around us is grace. You have to have a level of grace and show up with it in all the ways that you interact. Talk to us about your thoughts about showing up with grace, Kyle.
Yeah. I mean, grace is one of those words that I feel is an amalgam of other sort of adjectives and ways of describing behavior, and all of the other ones approximate, but grace is this word that captures it all in a je ne sais quoi, right? I don't think there's another word that captures it. What makes it difficult to define, it's kind of a word that you can see in action. It's easier to give an example of someone showing grace. I think an example of grace would be when, let's take an example of someone who is at the top of their craft, of their game, in the art world, in the entertainment world, in the business world, and there's a young up-and-comer, right? And the young up-and-comer is nipping at the master's heels, and the master worked really hard and had a great deal of pride in having achieved this kind of pinnacle of success in that endeavor. But it's pretty clear that the up-and-comer is going to bypass. They're going to eclipse the master. And the grace for me is that, I'm almost getting emotional. A grace for me is when that eclipse happens, the first person to congratulate and support the up-and-comer is the master. And it is clear to anyone observing it, the genuine pride and the genuine appreciation and admiration of that young person. No part of it. There's no bitterness. There's no regret. There's nothing. It is so clear that this person has done the work. And the master is nothing more than deeply respectful of someone who has done something that they understand. They understand better than anybody how hard this person has worked, and they deserve it. And they gracefully bow to the side and acknowledge the new master. That's just one example, but that would be grace. And unfortunately, all those ways is that for a whole bunch of reasons, which in my effort at grace is trying not to judge people who might come up short of that standard I just set, right? So people who find it difficult to be graceful in that and feel very threatened by the up-and-comer and still having some space in your heart to understand what's happening for that master, even though you wish they behaved better, you're not judging them and condemning them for not being able to rise to that. And you create an opportunity, maybe in that moment, maybe at the crowning ceremony, the conversation, the master isn't the best they could be, but you try to give some space. Maybe they get there 2 weeks later, maybe they get there a year later, but you create an opportunity for them to continue to aspire to show up in a way beyond which they were able to in that moment. For me, that's grace, is creating that opportunity for people to show that they wanna do better, they wanna show up better, and constantly trusting that with the right opportunity and circumstances that they will.
Oh, that is so precious. You've reminded me of something I'd love to have your comments on. Some years ago, I'm not going to go into the whole story. It was very funny, but I got my comeuppance from someone. And when they bested me, the words that came out of my mouth were something that my dad used to say. My dad was a physician surgeon, but he was also the farmer that knew how to slaughter hogs and make head cheese. So complex guy.
Yeah, for sure.
And he used to say to everyone, he had patients that were prisoners at a maximum security prison in our little town. He had patients that were every walk of life. And he always assumed someone could improve his way of thinking. Always. And he used to just say that to people. And when this woman bested me on something I was spouting off, I'll know it all about, all of a sudden my dad's words came back to me. And I said, "Janine, you have so improved my way of thinking. Thank you so much." So I think that's a part of grace too. When we talk to me, you are a master at making other people feel really heard and validated. Talk to me about what life has taught you about how others can improve our way of thinking, even when we're strident.
I think, I'm not going to get the quote right, but it's out there. You've certainly encountered, but like the greatest gift we can often give someone is listening, right? Life is a story. Basically, the humankind is a story, right? If we don't have a story, the Bible, the Quran, the revolution, the Constitution, all of it's a story. It's a story we tell ourselves about who we are, what we do, what we've created, where we're headed, where we've come from. So listening is really recognizing and celebrating the humanity of the individual whom we're listening to. Because that's their humanity, their being, their existence is their story. And so if you do it appropriately, I haven't run into someone who doesn't dig telling their story. Even the most reticent, reluctant people, if you show up the right way, sometimes it's humor, sometimes it's pathos, right? Sometimes it's, and over time doing the work, you learn things in your research. I'm a researcher because I'll talk to anyone all the time. I can talk. This podcast will be evidence of that. I really enjoy talking, which is part of the reason I like listening too, because I subject people to a lot of language. So I like to return the favor and make sure I'm doing some listening. But yeah, you just go there with curiosity. People will, as they tell their story, the next appropriate prompt or question will present itself to help them move along. And then before you know it, you're just wrapped up in it. And this person's on a ride. So part of, I think, the challenge for us to move towards goodness is to allow stuff to fall away, because I think goodness is the core. Goodness is the way we want to be. And fundamentally, I think it's that which is at the core of all of us. but it gets covered up in a lot of stuff. And if you can allow someone to get lost in their story, I think stuff falls away. It's almost like a trance, and people move to another space where the better angels become, just have more space to thrive, flourish, and emerge.
Oh, that is so true. Now you've given me goosebumps three times. This better angels is a concept. Okay, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, Kyle and I are going to talk about the better angels of our nature. I think that's the phrase. And how we get there and how we remain there as much as humanly possible. And also something that I think ties into that is this work. You've heard Kyle and I mention do the work. This is a really important concept in our future. So let's take a break. And when we come back, we'll enjoy more with Kyle Dodson.
You know how the constant negative noise in our digital lives feels like it's reaching a boiling point? Now, many of us have tuned out the news and social media almost entirely. Well, it doesn't have to be that way. There are newsworthy stories about amazing progress, innovation, leaps in human potential, and wonders in the natural world, and they're just not reaching the top of our feeds. We can have access to this, but none of us has the time or maybe even the emotional stamina to search through all the doom and gloom news to find what's right with the world. Okay, enter the Goodness Exchange. There, we are giving instant access to positive news for curious people. Did you hear about the recent Harvard study that found that exposure to just 4 minutes of good news can make you 32% less anxious and 18% more optimistic? Well, I don't know about you, but I need those kind of numbers in my life. So if you want to live with more joy and way less fear, it's really simple. First, you join us at the Goodness Exchange. Everyone around the world has the opportunity to access this kind of content. And we've promised no politics for about a decade, so you're safe from all that distraction as well. Second, you allow this new, more positive, balanced worldview to put a spring in your step again. It can change the way you react to your kids, your coworkers, everybody you come in contact with. And the stories we write about can make you the idea person in your circles. These challenging times call for us to wake up and take control of our perspective. The people who use the Goodness Exchange have the ability to react to the harshness of the world much different because they know way more about what's right with the world. And that's a resource. So subscribe to the Goodness Exchange, our YouTube channel and the podcast, and use this content to live a more expansive worldview. It is still an amazing world out there, and you can be a part of it. Welcome to the Conspiracy of Goodness.
Okay, we're back. So Kyle, we got to get right on this topic of doing the work, actually doing the work. And I'm hoping you can explain what we both mean by that better than I can, but I'll start us off by saying you and I recognized in our conversations together that there's folks who have done the work. You've referred to it a few times in this interview already. They've just really hit their education hard. They're well-read. They have been in there thick and thin for quite some time. And they are the ones who you and I both agree we like to give our attention to these days. We're not really giving our attention to to folks who have, you know, sudden meteoric rise for some accident of YouTube or something. So talk to us about this concept of doing the work.
Yes, Linda, that's a wonderful invitation. So doing the work in a way that doesn't nearly capture it is certainly in significant part about preparation. But I think maybe the distinction that I would make is that the people who I've experienced who have most done the work have done the work without fully knowing how they're going to use the work. The work was built by a passion, a sense of belief. It was something they felt called to do, like along the lines of a calling. And then when people who've done the work most exhibit the work, they didn't know that that opportunity was going to present itself just like that. They just happened to be ready to do the work because of the lived experiences, the reading, the travel, the everything they've done have made it so that it's clear when you experience them doing that thing, that they've done the work. I was thinking, I wanted to see if I could show, I'm going to try to give two examples of people who I think have done the work. One person who's one of my favorite writers, and I think, since we have people here on the screen, there's no shortage of people claiming to have some expertise or something to offer in the way of DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. Unfortunately, I think sometimes that gets simplified to, by virtue of the fact that I was born in this skin or this identity, I have the expertise to do the work. I do not subscribe to that. If I have anything to say about diversity, equity, and inclusion, which I will leave to others, I don't purport, it isn't because I was born a black man. It informs that, but it doesn't create the expertise, that fact. That's my opinion. Others would disagree. But one of my favorite people who didn't set out to talk about diversity, equity, and inclusion, he talked about humanity, is James Baldwin. But I find The Fire Next Time, one of his seminal texts, to be one of the best texts for me, talking about or providing guidance and a path to how we might think about a way out of this mess and this mess of not honoring the full humanity of all of us and allowing our fear and insecurities and petty grievances to wreak havoc in our communal spaces. So my understanding is James Baldwin was born in New York to a family where a very devout Christian family, not uncommon for black folks born at that time. And this is early 20th century. And I think his father was a preacher. And at an early age, Baldwin showed prodigious talents. He was preaching at like 10, 12, and like holding an audience. So he had a presence from a very early point. But when you read him, he also understood that he was a gay man from a pretty early point. And it's a huge issue because the history, and unfortunately, my sense is today, the black church still struggles with homosexuality. And it wasn't a struggle then. It was clear. It was an abomination. When he was coming up, 40s, 50s, there wasn't like any kind of equivocation about what the stance was towards homosexuality. So he knew he had this essence from what he understood that wasn't accepted. And so it caused tension with his father, but he was very proud and a big-spirited guy. It caused tension with his father, tension with his church, and created for him the sense to do the work to reconcile his deep Christianity and some of the things that Christianity said, which were in direct rejection of him. And I think that tension and the fact that he had such courage to hold that tension, the easy thing would have been to reject Christianity. And many do that with no judgment coming from me. It's an understandable thing why those who find themselves understanding themselves as being homosexual in who they are, that's part of what they are, often I think find they have to leave the church to fully kind of manifest who they are. I don't think Baldwin chose that. He hung in there and grappled with all the contradiction.
And wrote prodigiously about it all.
Wrote prodigiously about it all. And yes, always with this depth of humanity. You won't find a more scathing critique of racism, but within that you see love for all people, including white folks. He doesn't hate white folks. It never comes. He hates racism. And it's a very different thing. It's a hard thing to do. It's a very difficult thing to walk that line, but I think it comes through beautifully. And, I'm not myself a devout person, but I find the metaphor of that book, The Fire Next Time, at the end of the book, he quotes, God gave Noah the rainbow sign, no more water, the fire next time. And right. And so it's kind of like, I just got goosebumps on that one, Linda, that here's this guy, his humanity was so huge. He was warning us. He was beseeching us. Figure it out. Because it is prophecy that we live together, we conquer together, we achieve together, or we fail together. And the next time we blow this thing up, it's going to be a conflagration. He did the work of developing into a complex human being, and it showed in all of his writing and speaking and the way he showed up as a human in the world.
We need to be reminded constantly of these voices from other eras. As we run along the path, we're so often pushing anybody that you know, can't relate to our times with technology and everything else. We're just pushing their ideas aside in irrelevancy. But they, you know, but the biggest, most important bits of wisdom, they stand the test of time.
They do.
We can go back far. You know, another book. So we're going to put books like that. We'll put that in the show notes. Recommend.
Definitely.
Were you the one that talked to me at length about The Invisible Man?
I probably did. I love The Invisible Man. That's my other text. They're probably my two favorites. Very different approaches to some similar issues.
Yeah, I just ordered that today.
Did you?
Yes.
Yeah, it's got some of the best metaphors in it. Have you encountered the experience in the paint factory?
No.
Yet? All right, then I'm not going to share that now because I was going to share something, but I think it'll be better if you discover it. So we'll talk about it after you read it.
Okay, we'll challenge everyone else to get that book, Invisible Man.
Yes.
Okay, so one of the things we talked about in doing the work, you know, like it means the internal work, it means the external work, it means that, you know, you have street cred on an idea, not because you happen to make the compelling YouTube video, perhaps by accident, but because you have engaged in such depth on something that it's become part of what you're uniquely built to contribute.
Right.
But then there are people who do the work in such small, unheralded ways. And we need to hear more from them. But, you know, I said at the top of this podcast that we're trying to interview everybody from astronauts to someone I met on a park bench, because there are people doing the work in unheralded ways. You want to tell us about that great story about the people in the North End?
I do. I was, you know, I didn't remember us talking about this. And so there's so much my story that I was going to go back to it again, not remembering we had talked about it. So I don't think they would mind me outing them, but I'll use their first names. So Garth and Colby are a couple. I know Garth is a Vermonter, grew up in the Middlebury area. My sense, he grew up to like a working class family. Colby, I'm not sure that she's a Vermonter, but they both went to UVM and they've made a living here. So they're maybe just a little bit younger than me. So I would say they graduated from UVM in the late 80s, early 90s. Garth is a CPA. He's trained as an accountant and worked for one of our larger accounting firms for a long time. He recently left that job to move out and take his skills elsewhere, but longtime accountant. And Colby is in higher ed. She's at UVM in the School of Education, and she's a professor there. But they've lived in the Old North End of Burlington. And for the viewer, the Old North End is probably one of the most diverse and one of the most socioeconomically challenged neighborhoods in Burlington. And they've lived there as long as I've known them, so early 90s. And like many communities, in not as dramatic a way, but for lack of a better term, the Old North End has undergone some gentrification. And a magnet school was created there, which diversified their local community elementary school and made it a much more racially and socioeconomically diverse school. And I only say that because when that change happened, not surprisingly, it attracted newcomers and people who saw opportunities for them and their families in the community that didn't exist before, and they were drawn to it, which that's fine. That makes sense. But it deepens the respect that I have because Garth and Colby moved there long before that was happening. And I got to name it because it's the current time. Garth and Colby are white. And that area of town has the greatest concentration, arguably, of people of color. And if you know your history, that is not the most common thing in America. It's not very common for middle-class educated white people to choose to move into the most racially concentrated area of a community. It happens, and lovely, but that's not the story of generally of American residential settlement. So they are anomalous. I was going to say aberrant. Aberrant was too strong. They are anomalous in that. And they do it. They don't walk around pounding their chest. They don't say, look at us, great liberal white people. They just live. They have two boys and they raise their children in that neighborhood. And their act of, I would argue, kind of their subversive activity was to just choose to create community in a place that people like them don't often do that. Their home is open. I know their sons are in a similar age of my sons. So I see them in baseball teams and basketball stuff and community organizing. And their house was the place where all the kids went to do homework. And there was always an extra seat or two or five at the dinner table. And they engage children in their vacations. And often the children who were engaged in that way didn't have the same opportunities in their household. Garth and Colby went further. They would connect with that family. So they were supportive and connected with that family. And the family was a partnership. It was overt, and everyone accepted that the reality of all sorts of things that were beyond the control in the moment of that set of parents made it so that Garth and Colby often had more resources, more opportunity, and they were willing in the most open-hearted way to say, we're going to make what we have available to you, and we want to be part of your lives, and our children come to your home and take advantage and benefit from all the resources that you have at your disposal. And that trite idea of the village, they created the village. And as a result, there are arguably children who, by having that access, have gone to college who would not have gone to college. There are kids who've been able to avoid the lure of the streets and the lure of decision-making that often feels like all that's available to children who don't have access to the resource and support we wish they did. And there's more than enough example of that around in that community. There are, unfortunately, there are youth we've lost in that community. Youth who did end up being pulled on a track that wasn't healthy for them in the community. And some of them are no longer with us. These are children who would be 20 to 25 years old now, and they're no longer with us. So that's, and I only say that not to be dramatic, but to say it's no small thing what Garth and Colby have done. And they would be embarrassed by the idea of me heralding them like this. They have no interest in that. And that's what makes them incredible. It's small daily actions, but the impact has been outsized, in my opinion.
Yeah, so how many people are out there just doing what they can do exactly like that in an unheralded, uncelebrated, no expectations, just doing what they can do? And that's one of the things that we really like to talk about and celebrate on the Goodness Exchange and in everything we do on this podcast is folks that are just doing what they can do. And I'm sure you saw that in the whole fundraising years for the Y, this $20 million. I had no idea that it was that much, but you know, I'm sure you ran into the person who could donate $500,000 to the person who pulled $3, probably all they had in their pocketbook at the time, and everything in between. And it's just like, do it. There's probably some people who couldn't donate, but donated their time to some part of that process. I mean, that is back to our original concept, the generation of a sense of community in dynamic ways. It's all something that we can be a part of.
It absolutely is. And then a quick story that I think connects to that is the desire for all of us to tell our stories, to be heard, and to be accepted for and embraced for who we are at our core, and not just for the trappings or the things that are immediately available to the eye as it relates to who we might be. So I had the good fortune of being connected to a Vermonter who has done incredibly well and has vast, vast resources. And this individual, per the kind of tack that we're taking here in this conversation, if you saw this individual and you didn't know about them, you would never know the depth of resources. Drives a very simple car, wears L.L. Bean khakis and a flannel shirt, and doesn't do it to make a statement. That's just how they move through the world, how they see the world. And I've had the good fortune to develop a nice relationship with this person, which is, as a person who's part of my job was fundraising, lots of people would love to have that relationship. It's a kind of relationship that can be transformative. The philanthropy and gifts from this individual and family can be transformative. But I think it's because this individual and I believe, had a genuine relationship that transcended fundraising. We would meet and talk and spend time together and often talk about all sorts of things that are not directly related to fundraising. And interestingly, was one of the most generous supporters of the Y. And I don't know that I ever had to specifically ask for money. Oftentimes, we were in a conversation that was part of our relationship, and the individual would say, I understand your challenge. Would it be helpful if I were able to do this? Which you can imagine the answer was always yes. But it often was something that came as an offer rather than me making a direct solicitation, which was really lovely. And so I think that we had a relationship that was two human beings, and part of it was that I had a job to do and a need for the professional organization I support. This individual had a deep love for community and was in a position to be helpful in the quest to create a better home for that organization. And those two things overlapped, and that was able to happen. But the core of it, I don't think, was a fundraiser with a solicitation and philanthropists with a big bank account, but rather two humans that had the good fortune to come into contact and realize that there was a common interest that we had, and we could both contribute different things to helping make something happen.
That, not forgetting to just add in whatever you're uniquely built to contribute. I mean, it all adds up. Of all the people that I interview for the articles and the podcast, when I get down to the last question, which I will ask you in a little bit, about what do you really wish people knew, at least half of them say something related to the power of one individual. Everyone who's ever done anything that's worth celebrating knows the power of one positive person. That brings me to a quote that you and I both love that I'd love to have you comment on. Margaret Mead says, "Never believe that a few caring people can't change the world, because indeed that's all whoever has." What you got a story for that one?
Well, you know, it came to mind. You were, you know, I was like, we're moving towards the quote, just as, you know, as we were setting it up, just to reinforce your sense that we both are a fan of the quote. You know, I think we shouldn't quibble over the number, whether it's one, whether it's a few people, right? But for me, at least for me, the core of the quote is this idea that don't underestimate the power of intentionality and care and commitment to getting something done. And it's true. I think that all the things that have ever happened, you create in life. I'm a metaphor guy, right? I'm a fan of metaphor. And I think that on really big issues, they rarely are stagnant, right? Big dynamics want to move. So think about all the challenges. It doesn't want to be, it's something about nature. A standstill is not steady state, right? It's moving. It's always moving. And I love this idea I borrowed from science, and is valence. If you remember valence, right? Ions, neutrons, and protons, you have valence, positive, negative. So how we behave gives the valence to those things. They want to move, and they'll move in positive or negative ways based on how we behave, right? Because they want to go in that direction. So we either create virtuous cycles or vicious cycles. But nature has us moving towards one or the other, right? We don't generally stand still. And so our job, and my sense of what the few caring people can do, is create as many virtuous cycles as possible. And then virtuous cycles hit other virtuous cycles, and things start to happen. Things become possible that heretofore were not. You couldn't even see how that something could be the case. But now one piece of goodness is piled on top of another piece of goodness. You know, think about it. I think that, you know, an interesting example per maybe our current moment was the election of Barack Obama.
Okay.
Yes, we can. Barack Obama, a biracial man who identified deeply with his African-American history or ancestry, at some level was not supposed to be the president of the United States, right? A person who was defined as 3/5 of a human being in the founding documents that make it possible to have a president. And in the span of human time, 250 years or, you know, whatever the number is that we're at, the bicentennial or the founding of the country, was a short period of time to get there.
And wait, it was before we move on, I bet you there's a lot of people who don't know that 3/5 reference that you.
Yeah. Yeah. So in the Constitution.
Buff. He's also a history buff, so he can share that with us. Just give us a little.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm not an expert on it, but certainly, you know, the Constitution, the founding documents for the Union, for the Republic, as a compromise to deal with the fact that you were bringing together people who had recently or at the time, not recently, at the time, had other human beings, black chattel slaves, as property. And in order for the pieces of the Republic to come together and agree, there was this idea that blacks would be seen as 3/5 of the representation of a white American. And that prevents the political enfranchisement. So the founding documents did foresee or anticipate a time when Black people would not be property.
Right.
Right. But it also put in a hedge, I think, against the kind of enfranchisement becoming something that could threaten white interest, I think, to put it, crassly.
That is that. Okay. So back to the positive side.
But that is, once again, virtuous cycles. And virtuous cycles may be in the run up to 2008, but it was virtuous cycles from 1776, right? Things were happening that made it possible that people who were treated in such a way would then be the leader. I mean, I think a lot of people have trouble doing that because there's still so far to go as it relates to dealing with racism. But I think you can do both. I think it's incumbent upon us to do both, to celebrate and to recognize and acknowledge that unbelievable human achievement, while also insisting that there's so much further to go, that that's not enough. But once again, around virtuous cycles, it was a bunch of things positively connecting with each other, intersecting with each other, I believe, that created the possibility for the impossible, the seemingly impossible.
And just to, bring us down to what I think we're trying to share here is that we have a choice every day in what we engage in the news, what we engage in on Facebook, what we engage in, even conversations around the lunch table, whether we're engaging in virtuous cycles or we're, what was the opposite?
Vicious cycles.
Vicious cycles.
Right? We do. And the more we're aware of that, we can intentionally try to create more virtuous cycles.
Well, we got to move towards wrapping up here. And I want to share a quote with you that I'm not sure I shared before, so this could come out of nowhere, but I would love for you to comment this because we're so close. I can't leave this one alone. So there's a very famous social entrepreneur in the world. In most business circles, he's very well known. His name is Seth Godin. He has an amazing blog posting that I can't hit delete on. It comes out every day. I'm too busy for all of it. And I just have to dive into it every day. It's very short. I'll put a link to it there. Because about every third or fourth day, he says something I can't get out of my mind for the whole entire day. So this day, he said this. He said, "What matters is how we choose to direct our energy. Because tomorrow is the direct result of the way we spend our resources today. Pick your problem. Pick your future." Okay. What does that bring up?
So I'm going to move. I often, because it's an arena within which I've had some time and experience, look to sports to make sense of things. So what I hear you talking about is intentionality and focus, and how what we intend to do and what we focus on is where we end up. So two different sports things I can think of is in golf. When you are at the tee, right? So when you are beginning to hit the ball for the hole you're moving toward, part of what golf does is presents obstacles to make the game harder. There's the fairway, which is the smoothest grass and the place that your ball will move the best, and it gives you the best chance to achieve your goal. But along that way, to the side are trees. There is the rough, which is tall grass usually, where the ball does not move very well at all and from which it's hard to hit the ball. And there are sand traps. They're called traps, and you don't want to go to them. If you are a golfer who moves efficiently with the least amount of strokes to the hole, you do not focus on the trees, the rough, or the sand trap. You focus on the flag and the fairway and the green because that's where you want to go. And the quickest route to ending up in one of those obstacles is to focus on those obstacles. So your intentionality and focus, you go to the place where you're focused and you want to get to the hole in the most efficient way down the fairway to the green. So that's a sense in the same way, what Seth Godin was saying was the same thing. Tomorrow will be the thing you think about today. You will be probably living in that thing tomorrow. Another one, I love skiing. And in skiing, you have the trail, which we use often in skiing. We use French terminology, piste, P-I-S-T-E. And there's on-piste, en-piste, and off-piste. Off-piste is anything that's not a trail. So on a mountain, Engineers and architects have created trails to make us move easily down the mountain. But there's all sorts of other terrain that when you move to higher levels of skiing, you go off into that terrain for greater challenge. One of those places is the woods, a place where there's no trail and you have to make your trail. And once again, a competent wood skier is focusing on the openings because that's where you want to go. If you focus on the tree, it is very likely you will end up wrapped around a tree. To be a successful tree skier, you see the path that is the path, the chosen and desired path, and you focus on the chosen and desired path through the woods. And you effortlessly, when you have enough skill, can move that way because you go where your focus is. So those are two examples, I think, of the same concept that Seth Godin said, is that we need to focus on the thing we want if we actually want that thing to happen. And conversely, vicious cycle, if we focus on the thing we don't want, we end up going to the place that we don't want. And then we're wondering why we landed there often. We're like, how did I end up here?
Right. That is such a, those are two great analogies. Thanks for sharing those with me.
Yeah, my pleasure.
I'll really give some thought. Well, we're going to create a whole lot of assets out of this interview, and I'll make sure that's in the mini course. We create a short video, 4 to 8 minutes out of every conversation I have. And I think that was one worth re-listening to once in a while. So we stay on target with the way we want our tomorrows to turn out. So,
sounds good.
Lovely. So as we wrap up here, you know, I always like to wrap up, Kyle, with this question about what do you really wish people knew? If this interview had only been 3 minutes, what do you, sometimes, you know, you read the news or you're in a situation, you want to put your head in your hands. What do you really wish people knew?
I wish people understood at the deepest levels the power of curiosity and relationship. Right? We say those things, but they're like first amongst others. I think those two things have a power that's boundless. One of my favorite books, I got to imagine you have encountered this book, probably like it too, is Everything I Needed to Know I Learned in Kindergarten. Robert Fulghum. It came out in the 80s, maybe 70s. I don't know. It's an old book. And he was, I believe, a pastor. He had a religious training, but he just talked about the fact that there's all sorts of things that we're taught and experienced in kindergarten. And it's very simple, right? It's distilled because the learner is young, but in it is almost everything's there. And I believe that children are born without all the stuff. They don't have the garbage. And depending on the environment, it's amazing how early adults can inculcate in those young minds and hearts things that are not part of the virtuous cycle. But if we catch them before that happens, there's something beautiful about a child. It's curious, and it doesn't, there's no judgment. Children aren't born. We don't know how to judge people the way we end up moving towards as we mature. And so if we can bring that, in the best sense of the word, that childlike, that innocent curiosity to our encounters. And if we know that we live and thrive through relationship, that is the thing that most distinguishes humans, I understand, in the mammalian kingdom, is our social nature. There are other mammals that are social, but we're the most. And in isolation, we generally fare very poorly. We want and need to be in relationship. And we forget that all the time. We lose sight of that. And we actually reject people and push people away when what we really want is to pull people into our heart, pull people into our lives. So those two things, just understand that as yourself and then have the courage and the humility to move forth with curiosity and with an openness. Doesn't mean you have to be in relationship with everyone, but if you create the possibility, it's amazing what happens. Quickly on relationship, I've had such good experiences that I do it. So my girlfriend and I were over the Christmas holidays, we were in Ghana and Senegal. So in Ghana and Senegal, we ended up in Senegal and we were at a resort at the end of the trip. And at that resort was a couple who one night we were having cocktails and we got to chatting with them. And randomly, small world, they're from Quebec. So here we are in Senegal and they're from 2 hours from where we are in the whole globe, right? You could be from anywhere in the world. And there aren't a lot of white folks from this part of the world in Western Africa. So it makes it a little more, right? If you go to Bahamas, maybe it's not as weird, but in West Africa, there were not a lot of white folks from North America in Western Africa. So we're there, we're talking to them. He was there, interesting. He was a military guy in Canada. Then he worked himself up into State Department. So he was there in kind of emissary, ambassador kind of role. But we had fun with him. We hung out at the pool with him. We had drinks with him, et cetera. And one day at the pool, they were really fun. There was a gift shop there. And they had another couple that they knew who were Europeans. I think they were Belgian. And so the four of them went to that shop and they bought flamingo bathing suits. So the men had flamingo swim trunks and women, one had a flamingo bikini, one had a flamingo one piece. And so it was this joke, and they did it because they just thought it was funny. So they bought it on the pump. So yesterday I learned that my middle son is going to go to the Kentucky Derby. And I was like, you got to have a seersucker suit and a straw boater. And so I looked on the web so I could show him a picture of the way I thought he needed to dress to go to Kentucky Derby. And it took me to this website with really fun, outlandish suits like you would wear, something like that. And on the website was a picture of flamingo suits. The woman had a flamingo dress and the guy had a flamingo suit. And so I sent through WhatsApp to this couple who we met, who it's hard to maintain relationship, right? Because they live in Senegal. And we had a great exchange, and it was like we were back together poolside, and they so loved it. They were like, send it over. I'll Venmo you. And we just had this great interaction. And so now I'm in relationship with these people, and they made my day. I think I gave them a little perk up, and my world was bigger. You know, we live here, you know, we live in Little Vermont. But yesterday, you know, through that interaction, my world was bigger.
So this is it, isn't it? Isn't it about, you don't have to wait to either stumble into community or to have community come to you and ask you in. You can create it right around you by being creative, by being open. I have to mention that by the time this episode publishes, we will have an amazing episode about building community and being willing to wear the flamingo trunks. Let's see, what will it be? Episode 175 will publish right before yours. Yeah, you're going to be 176.
Cool.
So I will refer people here at the end of your episode, since we're landing on this building community right where you are and taking the agency to start it by just being curious about others, with an episode with Abby Wren and Wade Holland. Back to Sea Change. They were two characters that were speakers at the September 2023 Sea Change event. And they are doing amazing things in the world by literally practicing a lot of the things that you've mentioned in today's episode. So thank you for reminding us of that, because it's something great for people to go to next. And I will put that in the show notes. Again, if you just want to get to the podcast page at the Goodness Exchange, it's going to be episode 175 with Abby Wren and Wade Holland. But your sense of being curious enough about others to just start community and then it goes out from there is exactly what those two are doing in the world.
Well, that's lovely. I need to point something out, Linda, because I think I live in a world where everything connects. I am one of the most inveterate synthesizers you'll ever meet. So as a reminder, we've discussed Ralph Ellison. You will find in the book that a great deal of the book talks about development of the self in the American context.
That's the Invisible Man book.
Invisible Man.
Ralph Ellison.
Ralph Ellison.
Okay.
Yep. And we've talked about James Baldwin, also talking about his experience as an American, a gay man and a black man in a racist nation, where he still writes a book that calls upon us, to all of us, to access our inner humanity and move beyond these petty identity-based prejudices and biases and realize the community that we're meant to be. And then we talked about the virtuous cycle, Obama, 3/5, the Constitution, which takes us back to 1776. And hope's not too much stretch. You just said that this episode will be 176. I couldn't help but see that coincidence. It seemed kind of interesting to me.
Absolutely. And you know, there's the last thing that we might finish on. I bet you're a big believer in leaving room for serendipity.
Absolutely. Serendipity is the most incredible thing.
We got to stop trying to control everything, right?
I love serendipity. You're absolutely right.
Yes. Lovely. Lovely. Oh, that's a whole nother story in my life. I had a 1-pound baby which you probably know about. Yeah. Well, our second child, Jens, our sons know each other because of the basketball world in Vermont. But my son's middle sister, Louise, was born weighing 1 pound. And boy, 4 months in the intensive care unit, that'll teach you to trust serendipity.
Wow, it will.
Because you have so little control over everything. You just have to learn to be present for whatever comes next. So this is a great way to wrap this conversation up. I tell you, Kyle, I've been wanting to have this conversation for 6 months. We finally made it happen. Thank you so much for joining us on the Conspiracy of Goodness podcast.
Thank you, Linda, for your persistence and for the invitation to have this conversation. I've enjoyed it immensely.
Yeah, well, people have probably seen through this whole thing that I have a slightly purple eye. We got almost down to schedule it for this week, and then I woke up looking like a prize fighter one day with some kind of weird eye infection. But we're almost there, and I thank you for your patience so much. This has been well worth waiting for, and I treasure the long pre-call conversations that we had.
So did I.
Okay, well, here's the big news, folks. I only got through about a third of the questions that I had planned for Kyle and all the things we could have talked about, because Kyle is a man of wisdom and better questions. We're going to have to have another conversation that we record at some point soon, and we'll keep at these questions because there's a lot more to share from Kyle's lived experience and his openness to the world.
You won't be surprised to know, Linda, that I have a great, better question story.
Okay. Should we leave it for next time? Or you want to close on it?
Whichever way you'd like to go.
Go for it.
Okay. So quickly, I don't know, when I moved to Vermont, which was a time of possibility for me, I left New York City, new life coming to Vermont. And I read this story. It was about a young man. He had the privilege and good fortune of going to Yale, a very highly rated school. His life was about to enter the next phase, and he was in a great position. He had been a football player and he was an actor. He was in New York City. I think he was going to be in a Neil Simon show, which is a very famous playwright, musical director. And so he's on top of the world. He's going out for the night. He had a motorcycle. He liked to drive a motorcycle. So he gets his motorcycle. He's going out for dinner, a date or whatever. He's driving. He is moving into an intersection. Next thing you know, he finds himself in a hospital. A bus or some large automobile had gone through the red light, hit him. And he's now in the hospital, and he's an amputee. I think one leg from the knee down. So here's this young man who's on top of the world, and all of a sudden he's in this position where he's really having a trouble hanging on to the zest for life, right? He's feeling, and he's saying, why me? As many people would, right? And so he spends some amount of time feeling sorry for himself. He's not able to act. He's in PT and recuperation forever. And then some experience happens where someone challenges him to do a road race. He finally gets a prosthetic that works reasonably well. He does his first road race. It's horrible. He's in pain. There's bleeding. It's just a really horrible thing. But he does it. He finishes 5K. And so he works himself up, and now he starts building himself back up to the athlete he once was and becoming a motivational speaker. And he gets to the point where he's actually competitive and he's competing in races and he's a motivational speaker and his life is back together. And, you know, just great story of triumph. So he's in a Ironman triathlon. So he's doing one of many people believe is one of the highest levels of athletic endeavor, right? 26 miles, a full marathon, 112 miles on a bike, and 2 miles swim. He's fit. He's ready. He's going to compete. He's doing this. He's riding. And then some crazy way in the bike portion of the event where there shouldn't be, there's an automobile and he has another accident on this thing. It's like, you can't make this up. So now he's in the hospital. And he is a quadriplegic. He's paralyzed from the neck down. And he's being interviewed and talking about this. And the interviewer can't help but say, how do you not get mired in just self-pity and the sense of asking yourself, why me? Why again? And he sits there and he says, I don't have magic for you. But what I've come to realize is there's just better questions. That's a question. You're right. It's a very strong question. It's a very obvious question. Why me? But something about my journey, something about the way all these things have come to make me who I am today, I feel fortunate to understand deeply that there are just better questions. And I've turned myself to those better questions.
Can't remember who it was, but one of the many wise people that I've interviewed shared something very much like that, in that if you're not getting the answer you want, ask a better question. It's the same. Like if we're down on ourselves or down on the world or, you know, down on the future because we just are overwhelmed by the negative noise and all the other complexities in life, you know, maybe there is a better question we could be asking ourselves about that moment or that time or possibility.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, oh my gosh, Kyle, thank you so much, Kyle Dodson, for joining us on the Conspiracy of Goodness podcast. You, my friend, are a charter member of the Conspiracy of Goodness of our times.
I'm very proud to be such.
Thank you for joining us. I hope that all these connections to goodness and progress and wise ways of thinking that we've talked to you about will carry you through your week, and you'll start finding the joy and wonder that we've been finding out there whenever we open up and invite the world into a mindset of possibility. Thank you so much, Kyle.
Thank you, Linda.